Major General Gordon Hall, Reel 5. General, do you consider that the Mechanization Board got what it was wanting from the outside firms in terms of what its demands?
Yes, I do. Their job was purely to guide and advise, and I think they did that very effectively. They were quite a small team, and they were personally responsible for quite a lot of the important new developments, notably, of course, the development of a transmission and steering system suitable for heavy tanks, which was done by Dr. Merritt when he was induced to join the Mechanization Board. But they had one or two very able officers in the board, and they did work covering almost the whole field. They did quite a lot to do with tank suspensions and tracks, and they were entirely responsible for the development of effective air cleaners for tanks, which had been a very serious problem in the years immediately before the war. The light tanks out in Egypt had suffered very severe engine wear, and a quite useful type of air cleaner called the concertina cleaner, which was a self-cleansing type. After you got it bunged up with sand, you pumped it a few times, and like a concertina, it blew the sand off the outside edge and you went off to a new start. It was, like all cleaners, it wasn't 100% efficient, but it performed very well. And as we had found in the days earlier, when we were operating Rolls-Royce armored cars with no air cleaners at all, that even a Rolls-Royce engine of that day, the Silver Ghost type, which had a speed range not exceeding about 2,000 RPM, the Rolls-Royce engines wore out in a few thousand miles. It was pretty essential to have really good air cleaning for these much larger and thirstier engines, which were operating in the big tanks. As you can imagine, an engine of what it may be, 20 litres, takes in an awful lot of air and an awful lot of sand.
And this idea stemmed from the Mechanization Board?
Well, everyone was becoming conscious of the need for air cleaning so as to reduce engine wear, but it was quite obvious in the case of tanks, which, particularly when they were operating in columns, were just travelling in a cloud of dust, abrasive sand. And I would say that the effectiveness of most of the air cleaners which are now used commercially in private motor car was partly due to that sort of work done by the Mechanization Board and also, I suppose, in parallel in America and other countries.
Did the board get involved in the other ideas that we've talked about today? Were they getting, if you like, their demands catered for? Would you say that the overall effect of their demands was met by the outside firms?
Yes. Insofar as they knew what they wanted, yes. I think they certainly were able to get anything they wanted. Vickers worked very happily under their general supervision. As I've told you, the superintendents of design had to work with them, and also with another thing which I haven't mentioned, and that is the research department at Woolwich. I don't know whether anyone else has spoken about this, but there was in addition to the superintendents of design, the inspectorates and mechanisation board, there was another technical authority in Woolwich called the Research Department, and their job was miscellaneous research into problems connected with armaments. And in the case of our tank problems, work was almost entirely confined to development of welded armour, because the process of riveting armour onto a chassis involved a tremendous lot of heavy grinding, because the edges, which were often compound angles, had to be ground so that you couldn't get a tooth-out feeler in between them anywhere along the plate, otherwise they were vulnerable to a bullet splash.
And this work was done at this...
The control of that development was done by the research department.
And you were involved in that? Were you in liaison with...
Not much. I knew about it and I had odd contacts with it, but I had no responsibility for it, really. The commercial firm who seemed to have done most in that field was Guy Motors, who had an armoured car contract, and they made the first trials of a welding rod called Armour Light, I think, which we, research department, obtained from a visit to Hungary, or could it be Czechoslovakia, I don't remember.
Did you have anything to do in your own work with this research department at Woolwich?
No, I never met any of them.
Did you have anything to do with Nuffield mechanisation?
Later on, a lot. And even a little at that time, because while I was in the War Office, Nuffield had one or two engineers down at the Mechanisation Experimental Establishment at Farnborough doing tests on the prototypes of the Christie tank, which became the A-13 and the Crusader, ultimately.
But you didn't have...
Not before the war. During the war, I met Nuffield and Thomas, who was... who became head of the firm later on, quite a lot.
Were you aware during this period of foreign designs of tanks and components, parts?
I doubt if we were at that time. Later on, immediately pre-war, we became very conscious of them. And there was a project for building Renault tanks in this country, and I had something to do with that. But I don't think we spent much time finding out about foreign designs, because we, having been the originators of the tank, were inclined to think that we had a monopoly of the best designs on that. And I think, with the possible exception of Germans, that is true. Even our much maligned tanks, which entered the war, were better than anybody else's.
Could you say a little about that Renault involvement, you said that?
Yes, it was a small-sized tank with armour a good deal heavier than any light tanks we had. It was primarily designed for accompanying the infantry into battle, but it was faster than our own infantry tank Mark I, and therefore could have other roles. It had quite a nice little cannon, whereas our infantry tank only had a machine gun. It had a low velocity 47mm, to the best of my recollection, or may have been 37mm. The feature which appealed to us was that the whole turret was made of a casting, and it struck our designers that that was the obvious way to make a turret. And we contracted with the French Ministère de l'Armement, who I think was a Mr. Dautry, to make a certain number of Renault turrets in this country for them. And we would have, had France not collapsed later on, we'd probably been manufacturing Renault tanks complete over here.
You had a Renault tank brought over, did you, in 1939?
I'm not sure. But we went over to France a fair amount. I mean, in the early part of the war, the very early part of the war, before Christmas in 1939, I myself went with a mission to Paris, and we visited the tank school at Sattery near Versailles, and we went for rides in all their current tanks, the Charbet. Their current tanks which encoded the Charbet, which was their prize tank, the one they were proudest of, and the Saumur, which was their latest cavalry tank. Both these tanks were quite good, and in some respects perhaps a little bit superior to some of our counterparts, but they were always rather short on gunpower, though their armour tended to be rather better than we had.
But pre-war, up and before the outbreak of war, you didn't have very much to do with the...
No, with the foreigners, no. We knew a bit about them, because, of course, Vickers were world salesmen for tanks, and they'd supplied tanks to China and Poland and all sorts of places, and they'd done trials over the Pripet marshes and developed amphibious tanks and things of that sort. So that we did know generally what was going on. We knew very little about Russia, except what Martel came back and told us, and we knew what the Germans were doing, but of course their tanks initially were not really very much more advanced than our own, and when they went into Austria with the tank force, they left them strewn all over the countryside, according to reports. And they were not very formidable. I mean, their main, most of their tanks, by far the most, were light tanks, which disappeared soon after the war really got going, because they couldn't live on the battlefield.
When Vickers were designing all for these foreign countries, did they tell you what they were doing?
Oh, yes. Yes, the main optical device which was used for a long time after the war started was a periscope which was just lifted straight from a Polish design. And that was a huge success. It was made in very large quantities in this country.
Was that the only example, or were there any others, you remember?
Of pinching... Well, I suppose welded armour, we must be... Welded armour was one of the things which we copied from the Czechs. We adopted their machine gun for tanks. I don't know that we copied much else.
These were countries that Vickers was supplying... During 1939, the Royal Armoured Corps was established. Did that affect you at all in your work in the War Office?
Not at all, no. Because it was purely an organisational and some administrative thing. We had already got some cavalry officers into the MGO's department. And so it really involved us in no change at all, until later on, when, of course, visiting units, see how they were getting on, which was very often part of our job, that extended our field considerably. But the immediate effect on MGO5 was not noticeable.
What do you think was the effect within the RTC of the change?
Well, they were furious to begin with, because it had the effect of taking away their individuality as a corps. You see, it had been the Royal Tank Corps before, and when the Royal Armed Corps was formed, including the cavalry and the tank corps, the battalions of the tank corps became regiments in this corps, and of course initially they didn't like that at all, but somebody or other pointed out to them that there were 8 battalions of the tank corps, and if they couldn't outnumber cavalry regiments who had each only got 1 regiment, they were poor stuff.
You weren't furious yourself then?
Oh, no. By this time, I'd virtually left regimental soldiering, you see, so that these things didn't matter to me. I was an individual on my own.
You were looking upon the tank corps as...
Oh, just one of our customers.
Yeah. You weren't regarded as, or regarding yourself as, a tank corps man within the War Office?
Well, initially I was. I was put there because I had what they called user experience, but of course that soon wears out. And by the time the Royal Art Corps was formed, my user experience was of no value at all, really, because it was not recent enough.
Did you find in the years up to the war, the last, say, 2 years, a great deal more money available?
Oh, yes.
How did this affect you?
Oh, tremendously. You see, I was talking earlier on about getting people in to design and build turret gears for tanks, and I mentioned that at least one had built a factory specially for the purpose. Well, that couldn't possibly have happened under the financial conditions obtaining when I first joined the MGO's department.
What year, what stage would you say this change in financial fluidity?
It was almost pari passu with a degree of fright in the cabinet, I think. I should say by 37 it had become noticeable, and then it accelerated at a very rapid rate right up to the war, when financial control just went into the background and the Treasury just became an organisation for recording expenditure rather than controlling it.
What happened to you immediately at the outbreak, in fact, of the war?
Well, I was in the Ministry of Supply, which had been taken away from the War Office before the war broke out, so that I was then operating not under the War Office, but the Ministry of Supply.
You were moved before...
Before the war, yes.
How long before the war?
Oh, not very long. I know I was, because I remember standing in the Adelphi building listening to the first air raid. I should say 4 months, 4 or 5 months perhaps, but not earlier than that.
And was this move, was it linked at all with the development of the Royal Armoured Corps? In fact?
No, nothing at all. It was again, generated by... political fright, you see. They said, here we are, starting war, we haven't got tanks, we can't possibly face the Germans if they were to invade us and all the rest. What can we do, and quickly? And the first thing they said, well, let's form a new ministry, a Ministry of Supply, to put all these things right and build and design tanks at high speed, which it did, of course.
Would you said at that period that... from your period from 35 to 39, you'd seen a great increase in the numbers of light tanks?
Oh, yes. I don't know the quantities involved, but my recollection is that in my earlier days in the War Office, our total tank numbers were around 80 or 90. And... when the war broke out, I think we had several hundred. And we had a number of other tanks as well. We were able to go to war with a few Matildas. And, of course, we had, I think, two battalions of infantry tank Mark I. That would be, about 120 or something of that sort.
But hadn't you lost a lot through being sent to Egypt, the Abyssinian crisis in 36? Had that affected you?
No, except far we followed the performance of the Italian tanks from intelligence reports. But, of course, they never used anything more than what we now call armoured personnel carriers, really. So it had very little bearing on what we were trying to do.
So you weren't involved in this? I thought there was some sort of roundup of light tanks to send off. During 1936, in fact.
To Abyssinia?
Not to Abyssinia, to Egypt.
There may have been, but it can't have been a very important one, because I was in charge of tank movements, and I would have known if it had been on a scale which denuded the country of light tanks. I mean, we may have sent a dozen extra light tanks out to Egypt, I can't remember, but certainly we didn't send an important force out there.
One final question, because we take it up to 39. Did you feel that the light tanks that you had were as capable as any other country, particularly Germany, was able to match against us?
Well, I thought they were the wrong shape, because they were grossly overloaded. You see, I told you about this constant horse trading between the people who wanted things and the designers who tried to keep to what they could produce. And the designers had been considerably overborne latterly, and so that they were constantly adding weight to these things while retaining the same mechanical gear on which to put it. And the result was that they became somewhat unstable, and they were too heavy, and they lost a certain amount of mobility and reliability in consequence. But I suppose they, by virtue of having slightly heavier armament, they were more effective, though, in fact, from what I know of it, they were almost completely ineffective in battle. I went out to Egypt shortly after Wavell's campaign, and all around the places where battles had been, there were knocked out light tanks. And it didn't look as if they'd had much of a fight. They weren't very battered, they were just either broken down or been penetrated by a 20-millimeter solothurn or something like that. And my conclusion was that they were pretty hopeless, and of course they were never used again after that. The only light tanks I can recall on our sides, that was what the Americans called a Chaffee, which was a rather bigger and much more effective light tank with a 37-millimeter gun in it. And those did quite well at a later stage in the desert, and a battalion of them was sent out to Burma, where I believe they also did quite well.
That's fine. Thank you very much, General.